Time Warner Audiobooks presents Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? By Philip K. Dick. Read by Matthew Modine with Callista Flockhart.
A merry little surge of electricity piped by automatic alarm from the mood organ beside his bed awakened Rick Deckard. Surprised, it always surprised him to find himself awake without prior notice, he rose from the bed, stood up in his multicolored pajamas, and stretched. Now, in her bed, his wife Iran opened her gray, unmerry eyes, blinked, then groaned and shut her eyes again. "You set your Penfield too weak," he said to her. "I'll reset it and you'll be awake and..."
"Keep your hands off my settings. I don't want to be awake."
He seated himself beside her and bent over. "If you set the surge up high enough, you'll be glad you're awake. That's the whole point. At setting C, it overcomes the threshold barring consciousness, as it does for me." He patted her bare, pale shoulder.
"Get your crude cop hands away."
"I'm not a cop." He felt irritable now, although he hadn't dialed for it.
"You're worse. You're a murderer hired by the cops."
"I've never killed a human being in my life."
"Just those poor Andes,"
Iran said. "I notice you've never had any hesitation as to spending the bounty money I bring home on whatever momentarily attracts your attention." He rose, strode to the console of his mood organ. "Instead of saving so we could buy a real sheep to replace that fake electric one upstairs, a mere electric animal, and me earning all that I've worked my way up to through the years." At his console, he hesitated between dialing for a thalamic suppressant, which would abolish his mood of rage, or a thalamic stimulant, which would make him irked enough to win the argument.
"If you dial for greater venom, then I'll dial the same. I'll dial the maximum, and you'll see a fight that makes every argument we've had up until now seem like nothing. Dial and see. Just try me."
She rose swiftly, loped to the console of her own mood organ, stood glaring at him, waiting. He sighed, defeated by her threat. "I'll dial what's on my schedule for today." Examining the schedule for January 3rd, 2021, he saw that a businesslike, professional attitude was called for. "If I dial by schedule," he said, "will you agree to also?" He waited, canny enough not to commit himself until his wife had agreed to follow suit.
"My schedule for today lists a 6-hour self-accusatory depression,"
Iran said. "What? Why did you schedule that? I didn't even know you could set it for that."
"I was sitting here one afternoon, and naturally I had turned on Buster Friendly and his friendly friends, and he was talking about a big news item he's about to break. And then that awful commercial came on, the one I hate, you know, for mountebank lead cod pieces. And so for a minute I shut off the sound, and I heard the building, this building. I heard the..."
She gestured. "Empty apartments?" Rick said. Sometimes he heard them at night when he was supposed to be asleep. Out in what had been before the war the suburbs, one could find buildings entirely empty, or so he had heard.
"At that moment,"
Iran said,
"when I had the TV sound off, I was in a 382 mood. I just dialed it. So although I heard the emptiness intellectually, I didn't feel it. But then I realized how unhealthy it was, sensing the absence of life, not just in this building, but everywhere, and not reacting. Do you see?" "I guess you don't. But that used to be considered a sign of mental illness. They called it absence of appropriate affect. So I left the TV sound off, and I sat down at my mood organ, and I experimented. And I finally found a setting for despair."
Her dark, pert face showed satisfaction, as if she had achieved something of worth.
"So I put it on my schedule for twice a month. I think that's a reasonable amount of time to feel hopeless about everything, about staying here on Earth after everybody who's smart has emigrated, don't you think?"
"But a mood like that," Rick said, "you're apt to stay in it, not dial your way out."
"I program an automatic resetting for 3 hours later,"
his wife said.
"A 481. New hope that..."
"I know 481. Listen, even with an automatic cutoff, it's dangerous to undergo a depression. Forget what you've scheduled and I'll forget what I've scheduled. We'll dial a 104 together and both experience it. And then, You stay in it while I reset mine for my usual business-like attitude. That way, I'll want to hop up to the roof and check out the sheep and then head for the office. Meanwhile, I'll know you're not sitting here brooding with no TV. He released her slim, long fingers, passed through the spacious apartment to the living room, where he bent to turn on the TV. From the bedroom, Iran's voice came.
I can't stand TV before breakfast.
Dial 888, Rick said. The desire to watch TV no matter what's on.
I don't feel like dialing anything at all now.
Then dial 3.
I can't dial a setting that stimulates my cerebral cortex into wanting to dial. If I don't want to dial, I don't want to dial that most of all. Because then I will want to dial, and wanting to dial is right now the most alien drive I can imagine. I just want to sit here on the bed and stare at the floor.
Rick turned up the TV sound, and the voice of Buster Friendly boomed out. Well, ho ho ho, folks. Time now for a brief note on today's weather. The Mongoose satellite reports that fallout will be especially pronounced toward noon, and then will taper off. So all you folks who'll be venturing out... Appearing beside him, Iran shut off the TV set.
Okay, I give up. I'll dial. Anything you want me to be. Ecstatic sexual bliss. I feel so bad I'll even endure that. What the hell? What difference does it make?
I'll dial for both of us, Rick said and led her back into the bedroom. There, at her console, he dialed 594, pleased acknowledgement of husband's superior wisdom in all matters. On his own console, he dialed for a creative and fresh attitude toward his job, although this he hardly needed. Such was his habitual, innate approach without recourse to Penfield artificial brain stimulation. After a hurried breakfast, he ascended, clad for venturing out, including his Ajax model Montebank lead codpiece, to the covered roof pasture whereon his electric sheep grazed. Whereon it, sophisticated piece of hardware that it was, chomped away in simulated contentment, bamboozling other tenants of the building. Of course, some of their animals undoubtedly consisted of electronic circuitry fakes, too. The morning air, spilling over with radioactive motes, gray and sun-beclouding, belched about him. He sniffed involuntarily the taint of death. Well, that was too strong a description for it, he decided. The legacy of World War Terminus had diminished in potency. Those who could not survive the dust had passed into oblivion years ago, and the dust, weaker now in confronting the strong survivors, only deranged minds and genetic properties. Despite his lead codpiece, the dust undoubtedly filtered in and at him. So far, medical checkups taken monthly confirmed him as a regular, a man who could reproduce within the tolerances set by law. Any month, however, the exam could reveal otherwise. Continually, new specials came into existence, created out of regulars by the omnipresent dust. The saying, currently blabbed by posters, TV ads, and government junk mail, ran, "Immigrate or degenerate. The choice is yours." Very true, Rick thought as he opened the gate to his little pasture and approached his electric sheep. But I can't immigrate, because of my job. The owner of the adjoining pasture, his Conap neighbor Bill Barber, hailed him. "My horse," Barber declared, "is pregnant." He indicated the big Percheron, which stood staring off into space. "What do you say to that?" "I say pretty soon you'll have two horses." Rick had reached his sheep now. It lay ruminating, alert eyes fixed on him in case he had brought any rolled oats. The alleged sheep contained an oat-tropic circuit. At the sight of such cereals, it would scramble up convincingly and amble over. "What's she pregnant by?" he asked. "The wind?" "I bought some of the highest quality fertilizing plasma available in California," Barber informed him, "through inside contacts I have with the State Animal Husbandry Board." "Ever thought of selling your horse?" Rick asked. He wished to God he had a horse, in fact, any animal. Owning and maintaining a fraud had a way of gradually demoralizing one, and yet from a social standpoint it had to be done, given the absence of the real article. "It would be immoral to sell my horse," Barber said. "Sell the colt, then. Having two animals is more immoral than not having any." "How do you mean? A lot of people have two animals, even three." Exploring in his coat pockets, Rick found his creased, much-studied copy of Sidney's Animal and Fowl Catalog January Supplement. He looked in the index, found Colts, and presently had the prevailing national price. "I can buy a Percheron Colt from Sidney's for $5,000, he said. "No, you can't. Look at the listings again. It's in italics. That means they don't have any in stock, but that would be the price if they did." "Suppose," Rick said, "I pay you $500 a month for 10 months, full catalog value." "Deckard, you don't understand about horses. There's a reason why Sidney's doesn't have any Percheron Colts in stock. Percheron Colts just don't change hands, at catalog value even. They're too scarce." "But," Rick interrupted, "for you to have two horses and me none, that violates the whole basic theological and moral structure of mercerism." "Well, you have your sheep. Hell, you can follow the ascent in your individual life, and when you grasp the two handles of empathy, you approach honorably. Now, if you didn't have that old sheep there, I'd see some logic in your position. Sure, if I had two animals and you didn't have any, I'd be helping deprive you of the true fusion with Mercer. But every family in this building has an animal of some sort." Going over to his sheep, Rick bent down, searching in the thick white wool. The fleece, at least, was genuine, until he found what he was looking for, the concealed control panel of the mechanism. He snapped open the panel covering. "See? You understand now why I want your colt so badly." "You poor guy. Has it always been this way?" "No. I had a real sheep originally. My wife's father gave it to us outright when he immigrated. Then about a year ago, remember that time I took it to the vet? You were up here that morning when I came out and found it lying on its side and it couldn't get up." "You got it to its feet," Barbara said. "But then after a minute or two of walking around, it fell over again." "Sheep get strange diseases," Rick said. "Tetanus. That's what mine died of. Tetanus." "Up here?" Barbara said. "On the roof?" "The hay," Rick explained. "That one time I didn't get all the wire off the bale. I left a piece in Groucho. That's what I called him then. Got a scratch and contracted tetanus. I took him to the vets and he died. And I thought about it, and finally I called one of those shops that manufacture artificial animals and I showed them the photograph of Groucho. They made this." He indicated the reclining ersatz animal. "It's a premium job, but..." He shrugged. "Well, it's just not the same," Barbara finished. "But almost. You feel the same doing it. You have to keep your eye on it exactly as you did when it was alive, because they break down, and everyone in the building knows. I've had it at the repair shop 6 times. The repair outfit's truck is, of course, marked Animal Hospital something, and the driver dresses like a vet, completely in white." He glanced suddenly at his watch, remembering the time. "I have to get to work," he said. "I'll see you this evening." As he started toward his car, Barbara called after him. "I won't say anything to anybody here in the building." "I don't know," Rick said. "Maybe it doesn't make any difference. But they'll look down on you. Not all of them, but some. You know how people are about not taking care of an animal? They consider it immoral and anti-empathic. I mean, technically it's not a crime like it was right after WWT, but the feeling's still there." "God," Rick said. "I want to have an animal. I keep trying to buy one, but on my salary, on what a city employee makes." "Well, you could buy a cat. Cats are cheap. Look in your Sidney's catalog." "I don't want a domestic pet," Rick said. "I want what I originally had, a large animal, a sheep, or if I could get the money, a cow or a steer or what you have, a horse." The bounty from retiring 5 Andes would do it, he realized. But, he thought, the 5 Andes first have to make their way to Earth from one of the colony planets. I can't control that. And even if I could, the Andes would specifically have to take up residence in Northern California. "Buy a cricket," Barber suggested. "Or a mouse. Hey, for $25 you can buy a full-grown mouse." "Your horse could die," Rick said, "like Groucho died, without warning." He strode off, car key in his hand. "Sorry if I offended you," Barber said. In silence, Rick Deckard plucked open the door to his hover car. He had nothing further to say to his neighbor. His mind was on his work, on the day ahead. In a giant, empty, decaying building which had once housed thousands, a single TV set hawked its wares to an uninhabited room. The ownerless ruin had, before World War Terminus, been tended and maintained. Here had been the suburbs of San Francisco. No one today remembered why the war had come about or who, if anyone, had won. The dust, which had contaminated most of the planet's surface, had originated in no country, and no one, even the wartime enemy, had planned on it. First, strangely, the owls had died. After the owls, of course, the other birds followed, but by then the mystery had been grasped and understood. A meager colonization program had been underway before the war, but now that the sun had ceased to shine on Earth, the colonization entered an entirely new phase. In connection with this, a weapon of war, the synthetic freedom fighter, had been modified. Able to function on an alien world, the humanoid robot, strictly speaking, the organic android, had become the mobile donkey engine of the colonization program. Under UN law, each immigrant automatically received possession of an android subtype of his choice, and by 2019, the variety of subtypes passed all understanding, in the manner of American automobiles of the 1960s. The UN had made it easy to immigrate, difficult if not impossible to stay. Loitering on Earth potentially meant finding oneself abruptly classed as biologically unacceptable. Once pegged as special, a citizen, even if accepting sterilization, dropped out of history. He ceased, in effect, to be part of mankind. And yet thousands of individuals remained, most of them constellated in urban areas where they could physically see one another, take heart at their mutual presence. Those appeared to be the relatively sane ones, and, in dubious addition to them, occasional peculiar entities remained in the virtually abandoned suburbs. John Isidore, being yammered at by the television set in his living room as he shaved in the bathroom, was one of these. "I wonder if I'm late for work," Isidore wondered. He did not own a working clock. Generally, he depended on the TV for time signals, but today was Interspace Horizon Day, evidently. Anyhow, the TV claimed this to be the 5th or 6th anniversary of the founding of New America, the chief U.S. settlement on Mars, and his TV set, being partly broken, picked up only the channel which had been nationalized. The government in Washington, with its colonization program, constituted the sole sponsor which Isidore found himself forced to listen to. "Let's hear it from Miss Maggie Klugman," the TV announcer suggested. "A recent immigrant to Mars, Mrs. Klugman, in an interview taped live in New York, had this to say. Miss Klugman, how would you contrast your life on contaminated Earth with your new life here?"
"I think what I and my family of three noticed most was the dignity."
"Back on Earth, Miss Klugman, in the old days, did you also worry about finding yourself classified as special?"
"Oh, my husband and myself worried ourselves nearly to death. Of course, once we emigrated, that worry vanished. Fortunately, forever."
To himself, John Isidore thought acidly, "And it's gone away for me, too, without my having to immigrate." He had been a special now for over a year, and not merely in regard to the distorted genes which he carried. Worse still, he had failed to pass the minimum mental faculties test, which made him, in popular parlance, a chickenhead. Upon him the contempt of three planets descended. However, despite this, he survived. He had his job, driving a pickup and delivery truck for a false animal repair firm. His boss accepted him as human, and this he appreciated. Having finished shaving, Isidore strode into the living room and shut off the TV set. Silence. It flashed from the woodwork in the walls. It smote him with an awful total power. As he stood by the inert TV set, he experienced the silence as visible and, in its own way, alive. Alive. He wondered if the others who had remained on Earth experienced the void in this way. But whom could he compare notes with? He lived alone in this deteriorating, blind building of 1,000 uninhabited apartments, which, like all its counterparts, fell, day by day, into greater entropic ruin. "Okay," he thought, "I'm off to work." He reached for the doorknob that opened the way into the unlit hall, then shrank back as he glimpsed the vacuity of the rest of the building. It lay in wait for him. Out here, the force which he had felt busily penetrating his specific apartment. "God," he thought, and reshut the door. He was not ready for the trip up those clanging stairs to the empty roof where he had no animal. The echo of himself ascending, the echo of nothing. "Time to grasp the handles," he said to himself, and crossed the living room to the black empathy box. When he turned it on, the usual faint smell of negative ions surged from the power supply. He breathed in eagerly, already buoyed up. Then the cathode ray tube glowed like an imitation feeble TV image. Taking a deep breath to steady himself, he grasped the twin handles. The visual image congealed. He saw at once a famous landscape, the old brown barren ascent, with tufts of dried-out bone-like weeds poking slantedly into a dim and sunless sky. One single figure toiled its way up the hillside, an elderly man wearing a dull, featureless robe. The man, Wilbur Mercer, plodded ahead, and as he clutched the handles, John Isidore gradually experienced a waning of the living room in which he stood. He found himself, instead, as always before, entering the landscape of drab hill, drab sky. At the same time, he no longer witnessed the climb of the elderly man. His own feet now scraped, sought purchase among the familiar loose stones. He once again smelled the acrid haze of the sky, not Earth's sky, but of some place, alien, distant, and yet, by means of the empathy box, instantly available. He had crossed over, in the usual perplexing fashion, physical merging, accompanied by mental and spiritual identification with Wilbur Mercer, had reoccurred, as it did for everyone who at this moment clutched the handles, either here on Earth or on one of the colony planets. He experienced them, the others, incorporated the babble of their thoughts. They, and he, cared about one thing, the climb, the need to ascend. Today we are higher than yesterday, and tomorrow, he, Wilbur Mercer, glanced up at the view of the ascent ahead. Impossible to make out the end, too far, but it would come. A rock, hurled at him, struck his arm. He felt the pain. Who, he wondered, peering to see his tormentor. The old antagonists, manifesting themselves at the periphery of his vision, it, or they, had followed him all the way up the hill and they would remain until at the top. He remembered the top, the sudden leveling of the hill, when the climb ceased and the other part of it began. God, he thought in weariness. In what way is this fair? Why am I here alone like this, tormented by something I can't even see? And then, within him, the multiple babble of everyone else in the fusion broke the illusion of aloneness. You felt it too, he thought. Yes, the voices answered. We got hit. On the left arm. It hurts like hell. Once, he remembered, it had been different. Back before the curse had come. An earlier, happier part of life. They, his foster parents, Frank and Cora Mercer, had found him floating on an inflated rubber air rescue raft off the coast of New England. Or had it been Mexico? He did not now remember the circumstances. Childhood had been nice. He had loved all life, especially the animals, had in fact been able for a long time to bring dead animals back as they had been. But the killers had arrested him as a freak, more special than any of the other specials, and everything had changed. Local law prohibited the time-reversal faculty by which the dead returned to life. They had spelled it out to him during his 16th year. He continued for another year to do it secretly, in the still-remaining woods. But an old woman, whom he had never seen or heard of, had told. Without his parents' consent, they, the killers, had bombarded the unique nodule which had formed in his brain, had attacked it with radioactive cobalt, and this had plunged him into a different world. It had been a pit of corpses and dead bones, and he struggled for years to get up from it. The donkey, and especially the toad, the creatures most important to him, had vanished, had become extinct. Only rotting fragments remained. At last a bird, which had come there to die, told him where he was. He had sunk down into the tomb world. How long that part of the cycle had lasted, he did not know. Anyhow, he was no longer sinking. He had begun to ascend along with the others. Long ago he had lost sight of them. He found himself, evidently climbing, alone. But they were there, and he felt them, strangely, inside him. Isidore stood holding the two handles, experiencing himself as encompassing every other living thing, and then, reluctantly, he let go. It had to end, as always. Using a Kleenex, he dried his damaged arm and heard, muffled and far off, a TV set. It's someone else in the building, he thought wildly, unable to believe it. Not my TV. That's off. It's below, on another level entirely. I'm not alone here anymore, he realized. Another resident has moved in, taken one of the abandoned apartments, and close enough for me to hear him. Let's see, he thought rapidly. What do you do when a new resident moves in? On his way to work, Rick Deckard, as Lord knew how many other people, stopped briefly in front of one of San Francisco's larger pet shops along Animal Row. In the center of the block-long display window, an ostrich, in a clear plastic cage, returned his stare. Rick spent a few more minutes staring grimly at the price tag. He then continued on to the Hall of Justice on Lombard Street and found himself a quarter of an hour late for work. As Rick unlocked his office door, his superior, Police Inspector Harry Bryant, jug-eared and red-headed, hailed him. "Meet me at 9:30 at Dave Holden's office." Inspector Bryant flicked briefly through a clipboard of onion-skin typed sheets. "Holden is at Mount Zion Hospital with a laser tracked through his spine. He'll be there for a month at least, until they can get one of those new organic plastic spinal sections to take hold." "What's happened?" Rick asked, chilled. The department's chief bounty hunter had been all right yesterday. Bryant muttered over his shoulder something about 9:30 in Dave's office and departed. As he entered his own office, Rick heard the voice of his secretary, Ann Marston, behind him.
"Mr. Deckard, you know what happened to Mr. Holden? He got shot."
"Yeah?" he responded absently.
"It must have been one of those new extra clever Andys the Rosen Association is turning out. Did you read over the company's new brochure? The Nexus 6 brain unit is capable of selecting within a field of 2 trillion constituents, or 10 million separate neural pathways." "You missed the vid call this morning. Miss Wilde told me. It came through the switchboard exactly at 9.
"A call in?" Rick asked.
"A call out. By Mr. Bryant to the WPO in Russia, asking them if they would be willing to file a formal written complaint with the Rosen Association's factory representative East."
"Harry still wants the Nexus 6 brain unit withdrawn from the market?" He felt no surprise. Since the initial release of its specifications and performance charts, most police agencies which dealt with escaped Andes had been protesting. "The Soviet police can't do anything more than we can," he said. "Legally, the manufacturers of the Nexus 6 brain unit operated under colonial law, their parent auto factory being on Mars."
"Want to know what the Russian police said?"
Miss Marston asked.
"I know that, too."
Her freckled orange face glowed. "I'll find out from Harry Bryant," Rick said. Seating himself at his desk, he pointedly fished about in a drawer until Miss Marston, perceiving the hint, departed. From the drawer, he produced an ancient, creased manila envelope. He rummaged among the contents of the envelope until he came across what he wanted, the collected, extant data on the Nexus 6. A moment's reading vindicated Miss Marston's statement. The Nexus 6 android type surpassed several classes of human specials in terms of intelligence. But new scales of achievement, for example the Voight-Kampff empathy test, had emerged as criteria by which to judge. An android, no matter how gifted as to pure intellectual capacity, could make no sense out of the fusion which took place routinely among the followers of Mercerism, an experience which he, and virtually everyone else, managed with no difficulty. He had wondered, as had most people, precisely why an android bounced helplessly about when confronted by an empathy-measuring test. Empathy, evidently, existed only within the human community, whereas intelligence, to some degree, could be found throughout every phylum and order. For one thing, the empathic faculty probably required an unimpaired group instinct. A solitary organism, such as a spider, would have no use for it. In fact, it would tend to abort a spider's ability to survive. It would make him conscious of the desire to live on the part of his prey. Ultimately, the empathic gift blurred the boundaries between hunter and victim. Evidently, the humanoid robot constituted a solitary predator. Rick liked to think of them that way. It made his job palatable. In retiring, i.e. killing, an Andy, he did not violate the rule of life laid down by Mercer. "You shall kill only the killers," Mercer had told him the year empathy boxes first appeared on Earth. And in Mercerism, as it evolved into a full theology, the concept of the killers had grown insidiously. In Mercerism, an absolute evil plucked at the threadbare cloak of the tottering, ascending old man, but it was never clear who this evil presence was. A Mercerite sensed evil without understanding it. Put another way, a Mercerite was free to locate the nebulous presence of the killers wherever he saw fit. For Rick Deckard, an escaped humanoid robot which had killed its master, which had been equipped with an intelligence greater than that of many human beings, which had no regard for animals, which possessed no ability to feel empathic joy for another life's form's success or grief at its defeat. That, for him, epitomized the killers. "I see you brought the poop sheet on the new brain unit," Inspector Bryant said, hanging up the vidphone. "Yeah," Rick said. "I heard about it on the grapevine. How many Andes are involved, and how far did Dave get?"
8 to start with. Dave got the first 2.
"And the remaining 6 are here, in Northern California?"
"As far as we know, Dave thinks so. That was him I was talking to. I have his notes."
"I have nothing on my agenda," Rick offered. "I'm ready to take over in Dave's place."
Dave used the void camp scale in testing out the individuals he suspected. "You realize that this test isn't specific for the new brain units. No test is. Dave considered it accurate. Maybe it is. But I would suggest this. Before you take out after these 6, he tapped the pile of notes, "fly to Seattle and talk to the Rosen people. Have them supply you a representative sampling of types employing the new Nexus 6 unit."
"And put them through the void comp?" Rick said.
"I think I'll talk to the Rosen organization myself, while you're on the way," Bryant said. "I'm going to discuss the possibility of including several humans, as well as their new androids. But you won't know. It'll be my decision, in conjunction with the manufacturers. It should be set up by the time you get there."
He abruptly pointed at Rick, his face severe. "This is the first time you'll be acting as a senior bounty hunter. Dave knows a lot. He's got years of experience behind him."
"So have I," Rick said.
"You've handled assignments devolving to you from Dave's schedule. He's always decided exactly which ones to turn over to you. But now you've got 6 that he intended to retire himself, one of which managed to get him first. This one."
Bryant turned the notes around so that Rick could see. "Max Polakov. That's what it calls itself anyhow, assuming Dave was right. Everything is based on that assumption, this entire list. And yet the void comp scale has only been administered to the first 3, the 2 Dave retired and then Polakov. It was while Dave was administering the test, that's when Polakov lasered him."
"Which proves Dave was right," Rick said. "Otherwise, Polakov would have no motive."
"You get started for Seattle," Bryant said. "Don't tell them first. I'll handle it. Listen, when you run the void comp scale up there, if one of the humans fails to pass it..."
"That can't happen," Rick said.
"One day, a few weeks ago, I talked with Dave about exactly that. I had a memo from the Soviet police, WPO itself. A group of psychiatrists in Leningrad have approached the WPO with the following proposition. They want the latest and most accurate personality profile used in determining the presence of an android. In other words, the void comp scale, applied to a carefully selected group of schizoid and schizophrenic human patients. Those, specifically, which reveal what's called a flattening of effect. You've heard of that?"
"That's specifically what the scale measures," Rick said.
"Then you understand what they're worried about. The Leningrad psychiatrists think that a small class of human beings could not pass the void comp scale. If you tested them in line with police work, you'd assess them as humanoid robots. You'd be wrong, but by then they'd be dead."
"But these individuals," Rick said, "would all be..."
"They'd all be in institutions," Brian agreed. "They couldn't conceivably function in the outside world. They certainly couldn't go undetected as advanced psychotics, unless, of course, their breakdown had come recently and suddenly and no one had gotten around to noticing. But this could happen."
"A 1,000,000-to-1 odds," Rick said, but he saw the point.
"What worried Dave," Brian continued, "is this appearance of the new Nexus 6 type. The Rosen organization assured us that the Nexus 6 could be delineated by standard profile tests. We took their word for it. Now we're forced, as we knew we would be, to determine it on our own. That's what you'll be doing in Seattle. You understand that this could go wrong either way. If you can't pick out all the humanoid robots, then we have no reliable analytical tool and we'll never find the ones who are already escaping. If your scale factors out a human subject, identifies him as an android..." Bryant beamed at him icily. "It would be awkward." He picked the phone up. "You want to get started? Use a department car and fuel yourself at our pumps." When he landed the police department hover car on the roof of the Rosen Association building in Seattle, he found a young woman waiting for him. Black-haired and slender, she approached his car, her hands deep in the pockets of her brightly striped long coat.
"I'm Rachel Rosen. I guess you're Mr. Deckard.
This is not my idea, he said.
Yes, Inspector Bryant told us that. Is it true, Mr. Deckard, that you're a bounty hunter?
He shrugged, with reluctance, nodded.
You have no difficulty viewing an android as inert,
Rachel Rosen said.
So you can retire it, as they say.
Do you have the group selected for me? I'd like to. He broke off because all at once he had seen their animals. A major manufacturer of androids, he said thoughtfully, invests its surplus capital on living animals?
Look at the owl,
Rachel Rosen said.
Here, I'll wake it up for you.
She started toward a small, distant cage. There are no owls, he started to say. Sydney's, he thought, they listed in their catalog as extinct. It's artificial, he said.
No,
she smiled. But Sydney's listing.
We don't buy from Sydney's or from any other animal dealer. All our purchases are from private parties, and the prices we pay aren't reported.
For a long time he stood gazing at the owl, who dozed on its perch. If you sold your owl, he said, how much would you want for it, and how much of that down?
We would never sell our owl. And even if we sold it, you couldn't possibly pay the price.
Breaking away from the sight, it made absolute bitterness blend throughout his prior reaction of awe and yearning. He said, I'd like to test out the selection now. Can we go downstairs?
My uncle took the call from your superior. Uncle Eldon should have an android group and a control group set up by now. So let's go.
She strode toward the elevator, hands again thrust violently in the pockets of her coat. She did not look back. What have you got against me? He asked as they descended.
Well,
she said,
you, a little police department employee, are in a unique position. Know what I mean?
She gave him a malice-filled, sidelong glance. How much of your current output, he asked, consists of types equipped with the Nexus 6?
All,
Rachel said. I'm sure the Void Camp scale will work with them, he said.
And if it doesn't, we'll have to withdraw all Nexus 6 types from the market.
Her black eyes flamed up. She glowered at him as the elevator ceased descending and its doors slid back.
Because you police departments can't do an adequate job in the simple matter of detecting the minuscule number of Nexus 6s who balk.
A man, dapper and lean and elderly, approached. I'm Eldon Rolson, he explained as they shook hands. Listen, Deckard, you realize we don't manufacture anything here on Earth, right? We can't just phone down to the production and ask for a diverse flock of items. It's not that we don't want or intend to cooperate with you. Anyhow, I've done the best that I can. Indicating his department briefcase, Rick said, I'm ready to start. The senior Rosen's nervousness buoyed up his own confidence. They're afraid of me, he realized. I can probably force them to abandon manufacture of their Nexus 6 types. What I do during the next hour could conceivably determine the future of the Rosen Association here in the United States, in Russia, and on Mars. I wouldn't worry if I were you, Rick said as the two Rosens led him into a chic, living room-ish cubicle. From his briefcase, he fished out the Voight-Kampff apparatus and began to assemble the rather simple polygraphic instruments. You may send the first testee in, he informed Eldon Rosen, who looked more haggard than ever.
I'd like to watch,
Rachel said.
I've never seen an empathy test being administered. What do those things you have there measure?
This? He held up a flat adhesive disc with its trailing wires. Measures capillary dilation in the facial area. We know this to be a primary autonomic response, the so-called shame or blushing reaction to a morally shocking stimulus. It can't be controlled voluntarily, as can skin conductivity, respiration, and cardiac rate. He showed her the other instrument, a pencil beam light. This records fluctuations of tension within the eye muscles. Simultaneous with the blush phenomenon, there generally can be found a small but detectable movement of...
And these can't be found in androids?
They're not engendered by the stimuli questions, no. Although biologically they exist. Potentially.
Give me the test.
Why? Rick said. We selected her as your first subject, Eldon Rosen said. She may be an android. We're hoping you can tell. The small beam of white light shone steadily into the left eye of Rachel Rosen, and against her cheek, the wire mesh disc adhered. She seemed calm. Seated where he could catch the readings on the two gauges on the Voight-Kampff testing apparatus, Rick Deckard said, I'm going to outline a number of social situations. You are to express your reaction to each as quickly as possible. You will be timed, of course.
Go ahead, Mr. Deckard.
Rachel said. You're sitting, watching TV, and suddenly you discover a wasp crawling on your wrist.
I'd kill it,
Rachel said. The gauges registered almost nothing. He noted that and hunted cautiously for the next question. In a magazine, you come across a full-page picture of a nude girl.
Is this testing whether I'm an android or whether I'm homosexual?
The gauges did not register. Your husband likes the picture, he continued. Still, the gauges failed to indicate a reaction. The girl, he added, is lying face down on a beautiful bearskin rug. The gauges remained inert, and he said to himself, in android response, failing to detect the major element, the dead animal pelt. Her, its, mind is concentrating on other factors. Your husband hangs the picture on the wall of his study. He finished, and this time the needles moved.
I certainly wouldn't let him,
Rachel said. Okay, he said, nodding. Now a final question, two-part. You are watching an old movie on TV, a movie from before the war. It shows a banquet in progress. The guests are enjoying raw oysters.
Ugh,
Rachel said. The needle swung swiftly. The entree, he continued, consists of boiled dog stuffed with rice. The needles moved less this time. Are raw oysters more acceptable to you than a dish of boiled dog? Evidently not. He put his pencil down and shut off the beam of light, removed the adhesive patch from her cheek. You're an android, he said. That's the conclusion of the testing. I'm right, aren't I? She's not an android, the elder Rosen said. I don't believe it, Rick said.
Why would we lie?
Rachel said.
If anything, we'd lie the other way.
I want a bone marrow analysis made of you. It can eventually be organically determined whether you're an android or not. It's slow and painful, admittedly, but...
Legally, I can't be forced to undergo a bone marrow test. That's been established in the courts. Self-incrimination.
The issue is not the legality of the bone marrow analysis, Eldon Rosen said to Rick. The issue is that your empathy delineation test failed in response to my niece. I can explain why she scored as an android might. Rachel grew up aboard Salander 3. She was born on it. She spent 14 of her 18 years living off its tape library and what the 9 other crew members, all adults, knew about Earth. Then, as you know, the ship turned back a sixth of its way to Proxima. Otherwise, Rachel would have never seen Earth. Anyhow, not until her later life.
You would have retired me. In a police dragnet, I would have been killed. I've known that since I got here 4 years ago. This isn't the first time the Voight-Kampff test has been given to me. In fact, I rarely leave this building.
What were your instructions, Eldon Rosen asked, if you wound up designating a human as an android?
That's a departmental matter. He began restoring his testing gear. Obviously, he added, I was told to cancel further testing, as I'm now doing. If it failed once, there's no point in going on. He snapped the briefcase shut.
We could have defrauded you,
Rachel said.
Nothing forced us to admit you mistested me.
This problem, Rick said, stems entirely from your method of operation. Nobody forced your organization to evolve the production of humanoid robots to a point where
we produced what the colonists wanted, Eldon Rosen said. We followed the time-honored principle underlying every commercial venture. We knew the risk we were taking when we developed the Nexus 6 brain unit, but your Voight-Kampff test was a failure before we released that type of android. Your police department, others as well, may have retired, very probably have retired, authentic humans with underdeveloped empathic ability, such as my innocent niece here. Your position, Mr. Deckard, is extremely bad morally. Ours isn't.
In other words, Rick said, I'm not going to be given a chance to check out a single Nexus 6. You people dropped this schizoid girl on me beforehand.
We have you, Mr. Deckard.
Rachel Rosen agreed. She smiled. He could not make out, even now, how the Rosen Association had managed to snare him, and so easily.
Your superior, Mr. Bryant, Eldon Rosen said, will have difficulty understanding how you happened to let us void your testing apparatus before the test began.
He pointed toward the ceiling, and Rick saw the camera lens. His massive error in dealing with the Rosens had been recorded.
We can work something out, Eldon said. There's no need for anxiety.
Rachel, leaning toward Rick, said,
How would you like to own an owl?
I doubt I'll ever own an owl. But he knew what she meant. He understood the business the Rosen Association wanted to transact. Tension of a kind he never felt before manifested itself inside him.
"But an owl," Eldon Rosen said, "is the thing you want. I don't think he has any idea."
"Of course he does,"
Rachel contradicted.
"He knows exactly where this is heading, don't you, Mr. Deckard?"
Again she leaned toward him, and this time closer. He could smell a mild perfume about her, almost a warmth.
"You're practically there, Mr. Deckard. You practically have your owl."
To Eldon Rosen, she said.
"He's a bounty hunter, remember? So he lives off the bounty he makes, not his salary. Isn't that so, Mr. Deckard?"
He nodded.
"If you have no test you can administer, then there is no way you can identify an android. And if there's no way you can identify an android, there's no way you can collect your bounty. So if the Voight-Kampff scale has to be abandoned..."
"A new scale," Rick said, "will replace it. This has happened before."
"Eventually, of course, the Voight-Kampff scale will become obsolete,"
Rachel agreed.
"But not now. We're satisfied ourselves that it will delineate the Nexus 6 types. And we'd like you to proceed on that basis in your own particular, peculiar work."
She regarded him with intensity, trying to fathom his reaction.
"Tell him he can have his owl," Eldon Rosen grated.
"You can have the owl,"
Rachel said, still eyeing him.
"The one up on the roof. Scrappy. But we will want to mate it if we can get our hands on a male. And any offspring will be ours. That has to be absolutely understood."
"Give me some time," Rick said.
"Okay,"
Rachel said.
"We'll leave you in here where it's comfortable."
"Half an hour,"
Eldon Rosen said. He and Rachel filed toward the door of the room, silently. "You managed to set me up perfectly," Rick said. "You have it on tape that I missed on you. You know that my job depends on the use of the Voight-Kampff scale, and you own the goddamn owl."
"Your owl, dear,"
Rachel said.
"Remember? We'll tie your home address around its leg and have it fly down to San Francisco. It'll meet you when you get off work."
"It," he thought. "She keeps calling the owl it, not her. Just a second."
"You've decided?"
Rachel said. "I want," he said, opening his briefcase, "to ask you one more question from the Voight-Kampff scale. Sit down again." Rachel glanced at her uncle. He nodded, and she grudgingly returned, seating herself as before. Presently, he had the pencil of light trained on her right eye and the adhesive patch again in contact with her cheek. Rachel stared into the light rigidly. "My briefcase," Rick said as he rummaged for the Voight-Kampff forms. "Nice, isn't it? Department issue."
"Well, well,"
Rachel said. "Baby hide," Rick said. He stroked the black leather surface of the briefcase. 100% genuine human baby hide. He saw the two dial indicators gyrate frantically, but only after a pause. The reaction had come, but too late. "Thanks, Miss Rosen," he said, and gathered together the equipment. "That's all."
"You're leaving?"
Rachel asked. "Yes," he said. "I'm satisfied."
"Well, what about the other subjects?"
Rachel said. "The scale has been adequate in your case. I can extrapolate from that. It's clearly still effective." To Eldon Rosen, who slumped morosely in the door of the room, he said, "Does she know?" Sometimes they didn't. False memories had been tried various times, generally in the mistaken idea that through them reactions to testing would be altered.
"No," Eldon Rosen said. "We programmed her completely, but I think toward the end she suspected."
To the girl, he said, "You guessed when he asked for one more try." Pale, Rachel nodded fixedly.
"Don't be afraid of him. You're not an escaped android on Earth illegally. You're the property of the Rosen Association, used as a sales device for prospective immigrants."
"He's right," Rick said. "I'm not going to retire you, Miss Rosen. Good day." He started toward the door, then halted briefly. "Is this owl genuine?" Rachel glanced swiftly at the elder Rosen.
"He's leaving anyhow," Eldon Rosen said. "It doesn't matter. The owl is artificial. There are no owls."
Rick stepped numbly out into the corridor. No wonder law enforcement agencies were having so much trouble with the Nexus 6. Rachel, he realized, she must be a Nexus 6. "I'm seeing one of them for the first time, and they damn near did it. They came awfully damn close to undermining the Voight-Kampff scale, the only method we have for detecting them. And I have to face 6 more of them," he reflected, "before I'm finished." He would earn the bounty money, every cent, assuming he made it through alive. The TV set boomed, descending the great empty apartment building's dust-stricken stairs to the level below. John Isidore made out now the familiar voice of Buster Friendly, burbling happily to his system-wide vast audience. As Isidore knocked on the apartment door, the television died immediately into non-being.
"Hey," he called. "I live upstairs. I heard your TV. Let's meet, okay?"
He waited, listening.
"I brought you a cube of margarine," he said. "My name's J.R. Isidore, and I work for the well-known animal vet Mr. Hannibal Sloat. I'm reputable. I have a job. I drive Mr. Sloat's truck."
The door meagerly opened, and he saw within the apartment a girl who cringed and slunk away.
"You thought no one lived in this building," he said. "You thought it was abandoned."
Nodding, the girl whispered,
"Yes."
"But," Isidore said, "it's good to have neighbors. Heck, until you came along, I didn't have any."
"You're the only one?"
the girl asked.
"In this building besides me?"
She seemed less timid now. He saw that she had a nice figure, although small, and nice eyes markedly established by long black eyelashes.
"I'm the only one besides you," Isidore said, "and I won't bother you."
He felt glum. His offering, possessing the quality of an authentic old pre-war ritual, had not been accepted. In fact, the girl did not even seem aware of it. "Good old Buster," he said. "You like him?"
"Who?"
she began.
"Buster Friendly," he explained.
It seemed odd to him that this girl had never heard of the Earth's most knee-slapping TV comic.
"Where did you say you come from?" he asked.
"I don't see that it matters. I'll be glad to receive company later on when I'm more moved in. Right now, of course, it's out of the question."
"Why out of the question? I could help you unpack,"
he ventured. The door, now, had virtually shut in his face. "And your furniture?"
"I have no furniture. All these things, they were here."
"They won't do," Isidore said. He could tell that at a glance. The chairs, the carpet, the tables, all had rotted away. "Listen," he said, "if we go all over the building looking, we can probably find the things that aren't so tattered. A lamp from one apartment, a table from another."
"I'll do it. Myself. Thanks."
"You'd go into those apartments alone?"
"Why not?"
Again she shuddered nervously, grimacing in awareness of saying something wrong.
"I've tried it," Isidore said. "Once. After that, I just come home and go in my place and I don't think about the rest. The apartments in which no one lives, hundreds of them and all full of the possessions people had, like family photographs and clothes, those that died couldn't take anything and those that immigrated didn't want to. This building, except for my apartment, is completely kippelized."
"Kippelized?"
She did not comprehend.
"Kipple is useless objects, like junk mail or gum wrappers. When nobody's around, kipple reproduces itself."
"I see."
The girl regarded him uncertainly.
"There's the first law of kipple," he said. "Kipple drives out non-kipple. And in these apartments, there's been nobody there to fight the kipple."
"So it has taken over completely,"
the girl finished.
"Now I understand."
"Your place here," he said. "This apartment you've picked, it's too kippelized to live in. We can roll the kipple factor back. We can do, like I said, raid the other apartments, but..."
"But what?"
"We can't win," Isidore said.
"Why not?"
The girl stepped into the hall. "No one can win against kipple," he said. "It's a universal principle. The entire universe is moving toward a final state of total, absolute kippelization. Except, of course, for the upward climb of Wilbur Mercer." The girl eyed him.
"I don't see any relation."
"That's what Mercerism is all about. Don't you participate in fusion? Don't you own an empathy box?"
"I didn't bring mine with me. I assumed I'd find one here."
"But an empathy box is the most personal possession you have. It's an extension of your body. It's the way you touch other humans. It's the way you stop being alone. But you know that. Everybody knows that. Mercer even lets people like me..."
He broke off, but too late. He had already told her, and he could see by her face, by the flicker of sudden aversion, that she knew.
I almost passed the IQ test, he said. I'm not very special, only moderately. Not like some, you see. But that's what Mercer doesn't care about.
As far as I'm concerned,
the girl said,
you can count that as a major objection to Mercerism.
I guess I'll go back upstairs, he said. The girl watched him go, and then...
Wait.
Why?
I'll need you. For getting myself adequate furniture from other apartments, as you said. What time do you get home from work? You can help me then.
Could you maybe fix dinner for us, Isidore said, if I brought home the ingredients?
No. Some other time.
The girl moved back toward her apartment door. Did you get my name? John Isidore, and I work for...
You told me who you work for. Some incredible person named Hannibal Sloat, who I'm sure doesn't exist outside your imagination. My name is... I'm Rachel Rosen.
Of the Rosen Association? The system's largest manufacturer of humanoid robots used in the colonization program?
No. No, I never heard of them. I don't know anything about it. More of your chicken-head imagination, I suppose.
But your name suggests...
My name is Pris Stratton. That's my married name. I always use it. I never use any other name but Pris. You can call me Pris. No, you'd better address me as Miss Stratton, because we don't really know each other. At least, I don't know you.
The door shut after her, and he found himself alone in the dust-strewn hall. Well, so it goes, J.R. Isidore thought. Maybe she'll change her mind. She's really out of touch, he thought. For instance, she's never heard of Buster Friendly, and that's impossible. Buster is the most important human being alive, except, of course, for Wilbur Mercer. But Mercer, he reflected, isn't a human being. He evidently is an archetypal entity from the stars. But something about Buster Friendly irritated John Isidore. Why did Buster Friendly always chip away at Mercerism? No one else seemed bothered by it. Our minds, Isidore decided, they're fighting for control of our psychic selves. The empathy box on one hand, Buster's guffaws on the other. After parking the department's speedy, beefed-up hover car on the roof of the San Francisco Hall of Justice, bounty hunter Rick Deckard, briefcase in hand, descended to Harry Bryant's office. You're back awfully soon, his superior said. I got what you sent me for. Rick seated himself facing the desk. He set his briefcase down. How's Dave? He asked. Well enough for me to talk to him? I want to before I tackle the first of the Andes. You'll be trying for Polakov first, Bryant said. The one that lasered Dave. Best to get him right out of it, since he knows we've got him listed. Bryant reached for a sheet of onion skin paper, a blurred third or fourth carbon. Polakov has taken a job as a trash collector, a scavenger. Don't only specials do that kind of work? Polakov is mimicking a special. Are you sure about this void comp scale now? You're absolutely certain, from what happened up in Seattle, that... I am, Rick said. He did not amplify. I'll take your word for it. But there can't be even one slip-up. There never could be in Andy hunting. This is no different. The Nexus 6 is different. I already found my first one, Rick said. And Dave found two. Three, if you count Polakov. Okay, I'll retire Polakov today. He reached for the blurred carbon, the poop sheet on the android Polakov. One more item, Bryant said. A Soviet cop from the WPO is on his way here. While you were in Seattle, I got a call from him. Sandor Kadalyi is his name. What's he want? WPO is interested enough in the new Nexus 6 types that they want a man of theirs to be with you, an observer, and also, if he can, he'll assist you. It's for you to decide when and if he can be of value, but I've already given him the permission to tag along. Rick studied the poop sheet on Polakov. It gave a description of the man, or rather the Andy, and his current address in the place of business, the Bay Area Scavengers Company. Want to wait on the Polakov retirement until the Soviet cop gets here to help you? Brian asked. Rick bristled. I've always worked alone. Of course, it's your decision. I'll do whatever you say. But I'd just as soon tackle Polakov right now, without waiting for Kadalyi to hit town. You go ahead on your own, Bryant decided. And then on the next one, which will be Miss Luba Luft, you have the sheet on her too. You can bring in Kadalyi.